Welcome to Jaipur Bites. I'm your host, Laksh Datta. This episode is the edited version of a live session from the Jaipur Literature Festival 2021. Pandemics, Past and Future, Chinmay Tumbe and Laura Spinney in conversation with Ambarish Satwik.
Delighted to be in conversation with Laura Spinney and Chinmay Tumbe. You've heard about them in the introduction right now. They're both scholars, and both of them have written perhaps the most intricately assembled accounts of pandemics that you can ever encounter. Both books are very eminently readable, very riveting. I've read both of them, and I'm positively evangelical about both these books. Laura's book is an excavation of the mother of all pandemics, the flu pandemic of 1918. And it's not just a retelling of how it unraveled and the devastation it caused, but also it tells us about the effects of the pandemic and how it altered life and society and global politics and how it changed the course of history. And Chinmay's book is called The Age of Pandemics, 1817 to 1920. And it chronicles three pandemics, cholera, plague, and the flu pandemic. And perhaps the thrust of his argument, which is offered in conclusion, is that we seem to have banished the age of pandemics from our collective memory and also from standard issue historiography. And therefore, it's his attempt to locate the age of pandemics in global historiography of that particular age, that those 100 years which were defined by the rise of nationalism and colonialism and capitalism and globalization. So let me kick this off by asking both Laura and Chinmay to give executive summaries of their books, the sort of blurb jacket summary of their books. Laura, you first.
Wow, I think we could both be here all afternoon. I wholeheartedly agree with your point about pandemics having been relatively banished from collective memory. And so my goal, quite simply, was to set out to tell the story of the worst catastrophe, human catastrophe of the 20th century, possibly of all centuries. We can talk about that, the numbers are vague. The so-called Spanish flu, which wasn't Spanish, which killed between 50 and 100 million people, according to current estimates, infected one in three people on Earth, that's 500 million people, and I think cast a very long shadow over humanity. That's the short version.
Yeah, and the age of pandemics, from 1817, when the very virulent cholera strain breaks out, to 1920, after which actually all three, cholera, plague, and the flu, actually wane, is a remarkable sort of epoch. Again, tens of millions of people died. And for me, as someone based in India, what is remarkable is that the epicenter of mortality in all three of the pandemics was India. And yet, this is something which has just kind of vanished out of especially Indian sort of memory. We remember particular political events much more than epidemic history. And so what this book tries to do is, essentially, there are three core chapters on cholera, plague, and influenza. I've tried to locate using a variety of sources, including a massive mortality statistics database, including burial records, including oral histories, put together an idea of just how devastating it was. And I think my jacket sort of a nutshell argument is very simple. This is an age in which life expectancy rates in India were about 20, which means at birth, which means if you were born on average, you could live only 20 years. And these life expectancy numbers actually were falling roughly between 1870 and 1920. And at a time when Europe was kind of had major investments and they were cutting down mortality, increasing life expectancy. broadly put at a global level, in one line sort of, you know, argument, this is a period where the share of population of Asia actually falls from something like 65% to 50%. Now, this is a period where people talk about the rise of the West in economic terms, but people forget that it's also the kind of rise of the West in demographic terms. And in the sense, Asia population, many other countries' populations were curtailed or constrained by pandemics. And that is why it's kind of got short shrift, especially in the history outside the West. Because if you see what's the mortality in the West, it was much lesser relative to what happened in Asia, relative to what happened in India. And that is why I say we kind of consider this period to be about imperialism, nationalism, and all these things are important. But fundamentally, it would be like writing about the 14th century without the Black Death. This is, you know, a huge part of the century is pandemics.
Yeah, and why do you think this is the case? That, I mean, all of us in school have been given elaborate lessons on the Russian Revolution and the wars, and, you know, we know all about the Bengal famine, but there's absolutely nothing about these pandemics. Why do you think that has happened? Laura first.
Well, I was just going to widen it out a bit, in the sense that, you know, what we call crowd diseases, the infectious diseases that thrive in large populations of densely crowded human beings, 12,000 years since the farming revolution, and certainly for 5,000 years since the first cities. And I'm thinking, I mean, I'm fascinated by Chinmay's focusing on the Asian part of it, because that has been thoroughly neglected. But if you were to open it out globally, you could think of the 16th century, just for purposes of comparison, which we call the Age of Discovery, when the Europeans went out in their ships to the so-called New World and brought their horrible diseases with them, you know, and it was kind of a slow realization, I think, in the minds of historians, that actually those diseases did a lot of the work for them in devastating the populations in the places they arrived in their ships. And it was only kind of quite late, in, you know, not until the 20th century, that they realized that the imbalance that those the unbalanced effect those diseases had. So maybe that would be a kind of interesting parallel to explore, because, you know, there were pandemics back then. We've had 15 pandemics in the last 500 years. So it's not a new phenomenon.
Yeah, I think, you know, just building on to what Laura is saying, I think in a way, all history, especially in India, is political history. What we learn, what you said about learning in our textbooks, you know, Laura, you know, had this wonderful piece on the influenza in India. And we remember the 1919 Jallianwala Bagh tragedy, which happened in April 1919 in India due to the influenza. And yet we celebrate, you know, or commemorate that particular event. I think the kind of what gets recorded in history, I think the difference, if you think of categories of mass mortality, there's wars, there's natural disasters, and then there's pandemics. I think these are the, you know, core, and maybe famines and so on. But wars are always recorded. And that's, I think, because we have a clearly identifiable enemy. I think that's the reason, you know, and that's why in England, you know, the celebration of, say, World War I victory, World War II victory, and so on. In India, the victory against the British. And so these are events which then get recorded. And people, I think, try and want to forget very quickly episodes of mass mortality. But especially when there's no clearly identifiable enemy, and that's what we're saying, you know, a lot of pandemics is about. I think that is one of the major reasons as to why it, you know, quickly moves out of our collective memory. You know, when I was doing research on this book, when the 1957 flu kind of pandemic broke out, there was a letter to the editor in the Times of India who had lived through 1918 and said, we have to take precaution because we have seen 1918. You know, so that memory was there for that generation. But, you know, after the next generation kind of completely forgot. And so I think this period between 1960 and 2020, in a way, is a period of less lethal pandemics compared to the past. And I think that's one of the reasons people have kind of forgotten it in our generation.
Right. This question of collective memories, fascinating. And it's really it's the reason I wrote my book, because before I came to the subject of the so-called Spanish flu, I have to put so-called in front, we should probably call it the 1918 flu, because there was nothing Spanish about it, or nothing particularly Spanish about it. But I started thinking about this around 2013. I'd never really, although I'm a science journalist, I had never really focused on infectious diseases before. And the reason I came to it was because a lot of the editors I write for, because I'm freelance, were starting to think about how we would mark the centenary of the Great War, the First World War. And so we were thinking about science angles to that. And in the course of my research into all sorts of fascinating things like battlefield archaeology, I came across the estimated death toll of the 1918 pandemic. And I did a complete double take. I mean, why are we marking this centenary of a war which killed still a staggering number, of course, 18 million, but not even talking about this other event which totally overshadows it in terms of death? So the whole collective memory issue is what took me into that subject. And I totally agree with Chinmay that it's about the enemy not having a face, but I think there are other factors as well. I think, for example, if you take the Spanish flu, which now I hope it's clear I'm using as a shorthand, for much of the 20th century, it was thought that it had killed about 20 million people. Those were the first estimates that came out in the 1920s, which would put it in roughly the same ballpark as the First World War. And it was only at the end of the 20th century that those numbers were raised to 50 to 100 million, the numbers we work with now, although they're still contested. But I think in our collective consciousness, we had no real sense of its scale. And it was always seen as something that was vying with the war. I also think that a pandemic doesn't really lend itself very easily to a linear narrative, which is what we humans love, you know, a nice beginning, a middle and end, and of course, heroes and villains. You know, that pandemic, the majority of the people it killed died in 13 weeks between the middle of September and the middle of December 1918. So I think there are lots of reasons why it just sort of slips through the holes. Another point is sort of structural, if you like, which is that wars tend to destroy infrastructure as well as human beings, whereas pandemics don't destroy infrastructure, but they do destroy human beings. So I think we can recover more quickly from pandemics too.
Yeah, just very quickly after that, you know, last thing on numbers. In India, the operative number was about 5 million deaths. And it's much later when people start realizing it's 50 to 20 million. So that thing, and 5 million was very close to the people, you know, number mortality of famines. And so it was not seen to be something unusually large compared to what famines would take away. That's again, you know, one reason. Yeah.
You think, can I dive in here and be really annoying and ask a question of Chinmay, which is that, I mean, my feeling all along was, while I was researching this book, was that the numbers are too big for anybody to get their heads around. And I suspect that must be a particular problem in India, which, as you say, was the kind of epicenter in terms of the absolute numbers of dead, is that 18 million at a certain point just loses all meaning.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, to put it in perspective in today's thing, in November 1918, there were about 200,000 people dying every single day in India. And, you know, we've had less than that in COVID. I think the number today, as we speak, is 150,000 deaths in India today. So there were as many people dying every single day in November 1918. Yeah. So at some point, you know, and I think the death collection system, the statistical system falls, you know, when people are throwing out bodies on rivers and cliffs. So even counting deaths is completely different. Yeah.
Right. So, these numbers, the mass mortality statistics, are staggering. And, I think Lucretius made the case that people aren't afraid of death unless there's an immediate danger of dying. And the current ongoing pandemic, for many of us, forced us to kind of confront our own mortality. And I remember meeting Chinmay in the first or the second week of March when he had come to Delhi. And at that point, I think COVID was just about unraveling in Italy. And we were all with sort of fetishistic fervor watching the dashboard in the international dashboard and the number of deaths and the number of infections. And there was a sort of, almost vicarious sense of anxiety and that we were experiencing there. And it was only then that the full kind of impact and tenor of that famous John Donne poem, you know, hit us, because, you know, each man's death diminishes me, if I can quote correctly. Send not for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee. Because, you know, the trouble is that we in India, many of us don't have, we're not familiar with the practice of funeral tolling. So we never understood what that meant, you know, and the literality of death knell in that sense, it doesn't exist in the Indian languages or the Indian vernacular. But it was only then that we started viewing this with a very acute and real sense of vicarious anxiety and not Schadenfreude. But since you, Laura, have been tracking pandemics, did you think that the first four cases of pneumonia of unknown etiology in Wuhan would somehow reach this proportion and would turn into this full-blown kind of gobsmacking pandemic?
I certainly can't say I was one of the first to call it. I definitely wasn't. And, you know, we've had epidemics, for example, SARS, that were stamped out before they became pandemics, although they certainly have pandemic potential. So, you know, I do think certainly in Europe that we were very slow to react. You know, there was this sort of idea that it'll stay over there. and of course, you know, and I mean, we were caught on the back foot, no doubt about it. But I do think it's also quite difficult to say in the early days whether something will become, you know, has the potential to go global. And you're talking about a new disease by definition, a disease that humanity has never seen before. Flu is a slightly different case, of course, although each strain that causes a pandemic is novel to humanity, at least humanity that's alive on the planet that day. But I think what's really interesting, what's been really interesting to me over the last year is sort of seeing that normalization of death happen in stages. I mean, if you think about right at the beginning, you know, the word staggering kept cropping up, you know, for tens of deaths a day in one country, and then hundreds of deaths a day, and then thousands, you know, and we just kind of got used to it. Now, the other day I was talking to John Nkengasong, who's the director of the Africa CDC, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And he said to me, I mean, Africa is about to hit its grim milestone, as it keeps, as the cliche goes, of 100,000 deaths. And there's this narrative been going that Africa's been relatively protected against this pandemic, which is possible, difficult to understand, could be a lot of underreporting in there and so on. But his first point was, I just want to mark that milestone because 100,000 deaths is a lot of deaths. You know, whether you compare it to what's happening in the rest of the world or not, that is a lot of deaths. He said, if you'd told me a year ago that a new infection would have killed that many people by now, I wouldn't have believed you. No, it would have been too shocking. So I think, you know, it's seeing that process happen over the last year has been absolutely fascinating. And I think it probably happens in every pandemic, especially, I don't know what Chinmay thinks, especially in earlier times when infectious diseases were the main killers of humanity.
I think, you know, part of the story is also how quickly it can get around. You know, we're talking literally a few weeks in which this has got around. I think 1918, we can say, is also a few weeks, maybe slightly more delayed, maybe a few months. And if you go back to plague, you know, many more months. And when I start, my book starts in 1817, you know, it takes about 2 years when cholera, the new strain, emerges in Eastern India. It takes about 2 years to just touch all the Indian subcontinent. I think so. What's really different right now is the instantaneous news that we all, you know, experience the pandemic at the same time, and everyone knows about it. You know, in the 1918, one of the things which I found was in Western India, the disease was often called as Manmodi, and so many people did not really refer to it in one, like how we all refer to this as one disease. It had very different meanings in different parts of the world, and I think so. This is probably the first big pandemic where we are all collectively as a human race experiencing it and talking about it in pretty much similar languages like social distancing, mask, you know, everything, which I think was not maybe also the case, you know, in previous pandemics. And the thing is, talking about deaths, for me, for example, it came in very personally. This book is in fact dedicated to the librarian of our institute who passed away, unfortunately, due to the pandemic. And so it really hit us very hard, you know, a very close friend, and, you know, he's no longer there. And the least, you know, I could do was to, you know, dedicate this book to him, his family, and he's just done a fantastic job with the library. And so these are kind of personal experiences which really drive home that there's beyond something beyond numbers.
Mm. Let me ask you both, so if you were to compare this sort of tripartite wave pattern to the 1918 flu pandemic, you have a small wave around spring, followed by a much more lethal and more acute kind of wave in autumn, and then followed by another small wave in early 1919. Do you think that because both the influenza pandemic and the current one are respiratory mucosal infections, pandemics of respiratory mucosal infections, do you think it's following a similar kind of tripartite pattern?
I mean, they do seem to strike in waves, yeah. And I'm not sure that's completely understood. We're still trying to work out, it's not very clear because even in 1918, those three waves didn't strike everywhere. You know, they were staggered in time in the Southern Hemisphere with respect to the North. There's an idea that the third wave was actually the sort of tail end of the second wave that was interrupted by end of year holidays, children no longer at school, and things are changing kind of behavioral practices and movements of people that might have just interrupted the transmission for a while. So it's quite hard to, and that wasn't necessarily the same in every country. There does seem to be, in a very general sense, this wave structure to respiratory epidemics and pandemics, but whether it's the same mechanisms at work, I don't think it's completely clear yet. I mean, the interesting thing about 1918 is that there seems to have been this mutation in the late spring that took off in the viral population and that drove a much more virulent form of disease, to the extent that people thought that they were dealing with something different from the one that caused the first wave. Is that what's happening this time? Are we even there yet? I would hesitate to say, but clearly these new variants that are coming out, and of course also we have these new vaccines, that's totally unprecedented for such a novel pathogen. And are they also driving evolution in the virus? I'm sure they are, but I think it's a little early to see how this is all going to pan out.
Mm. Yeah, I write in the book, never celebrate the end of a pandemic, because you really don't know when it's going to end. And this is classic in the case of plague. When plague hit Bombay in 1896, after the first year, when plague retreated, the officials of the Bombay municipality celebrated, saying, we have done a great job in defeating plague. And then for the next 20 years, plague would keep coming every year, devastating not just Bombay city, but, Western India. Plague was a very seasonal disease, right? Like cholera. And in a way, over time, people kind of realized, they knew when the disease was coming. It became predictable in terms of, they knew that it was going to come in a few months of the year, and they would respond, accordingly. That's one potential way how this pandemic actually could go. It could either go like the 1918, where it kind of fizzles out in one or two waves, or if you consider the third wave. Or it kind of keeps coming through, it becomes almost seasonal. And of course, you get regional variation. And then these regional variations will be very puzzling, just like it was very puzzling during cholera, in plague. Just to give you an analogy, in India today, we say, why is Bombay having all this COVID? And I'm just coming from Bihar. Bihar seems to be, if you look at the per capita income map, this is a strange pandemic. 1918, the poorer parts got hit much more. Right now, the COVID mortality is almost perfectly lined up with per capita income. There's a lot of mysteries, which I don't think we have the answers for right now. And I think they'll come eventually.
Right.
Can I just add something there about what we mean by a pandemic? Because I think it's fascinating if you think about it. We think of something that sweeps across the world very quickly, which would fit the description of the Spanish flu and COVID. But plague moves much more slowly, as Chinmay says. We're in the grip, people keep forgetting we're in the grip of another pandemic at the moment, which is AIDS. I was just writing the other day about the possible next pandemic, happy subject, but antimicrobial resistance could be a different kind of pandemic, which would move much more slowly as well, and would consist of many different infections, all of which would be chronic and untreatable. So it's interesting how we think about what a pandemic is and how that's tied up with speed of it, how we have to become used to it, our use of the word, our distinction between endemic and epidemic, something that's there for good and something that moves through. Fascinating, the language of it when you think about it. And then how our understanding of whether it's something that's coming and going or whether it's something we have to live with changes our behavior in turn and changes our culture.
As Laura said, you know, the vaccination is very different. I mean, 1918, it came, it went, nobody really knew what happened. Out here, I think the knowledge is, you know, progressing very fast, and the vaccines are out. And so this might be the first, you know, one of the first pandemics which might potentially be curtailed to some extent by vaccine. We'll just have to wait and see how much that happens. I think 1918 also was a kind of a, in many places, herd immunity. I mean, it just kills so many people. And whoever, you know, the remaining people had that, most of them had caught it, and they kind of seemed to be immune after that. And so it kind of went through relatively very quickly. Whereas this one, precisely because there's been a global lockdown, which was not the case in 1918, precisely because people know many of the things which people did not know in 1918. I think a lot of these waves are also conditioned by our behavior. That is, once the, and it's kind of the data which is driving our actions, which is an In you know, it's leading back to the data. So the numbers are going up, then we behave in a particular way, and then we constrain ourselves from going out, and then the numbers start falling. And as they start falling again, we start going out, and again they start. So there's a kind of feedback loop between the data and our behavior. I think that's potentially one, you know, explanation for what's happening.
Right, but you mentioned how there's you know, you seem to be, there's this most perplexing question of how come the countries that have been worst affected are the ones with the highest GDP and the Human Development Index. In fact, there's a very provocative paper that's just been released, which speaks of this very dangerous kind of concept called hygiene hypothesis, by a very respectable and venerable epidemiologists and people who are interested in mathematical modeling, where they say, and this is from publicly available data from 106 countries, and you'll see that this is most perplexing. Countries like, there's a stark difference in mortality statistics between East Europe and West Europe. Stark difference in mortality statistics between the African countries and America. In India, what has happened, and there seems to be the idea that incidence of communicable disease is negatively correlated with mortality, and improved hygiene and higher incidence of autoimmune disorders, the nations that have it, are correlated positively with higher mortality. And this is not what happened in the flu pandemic of 1918, because your chance of dying in Asia was much, much more than your chance of dying in North America or Europe. But it will remain a very provocative hypothesis.
I think it's a dangerous one. I think it's far too early to say that. And, you know, I mean, talking to Médecins Sans Frontières the other day, they are on the ground in the worst affected parts of Africa at the moment, where they're putting tents up because there are not enough beds to treat the people. There's no oxygen. The case fatality rate, as blunt an instrument as that is in Africa, has recently gone above the global average, mainly because I think they don't have oxygen. So they don't have the means to treat the patients who get there. So, I mean, there was earlier last autumn a suggestion that, it's your suggestion essentially, highly provocative, that poverty protects and that people who live in crowded conditions where social distancing is not as easy to achieve are somehow getting some advantage from that, perhaps because I think the idea originally was that they were more exposed perhaps to the related coronaviruses, the ones that cause the common cold. But I don't think that pattern is consistent across the world. From what I understand, and of course we're looking at really messy epidemiological data where you can't, you know, and it's patchy and there's underreporting and things are defined differently in different places. You cannot, I don't think at this stage, take out cause and effect. But from what I can take away from the experts I've spoken to, the only things that are really, really clearly related to mortality are age and comorbidities. Those are the most powerful predictors at the moment. Everything else, it's not off the table, but I just think it's too early to say.
Right.
I think the hygiene hypothesis is very dangerous. I think, I mean, just to put it very bluntly, you know, India was a fairly filthy country in the age of pandemics, 1817 to 1920, and 40 million Indians died at the minimum. Right? So what was this hygiene, you know, not protecting the Indians from back then? I mean, obviously there's, I think it's just too early to say, but I just point out, you know, this thing about regional variation during the plague, Eastern India and Southern India barely got the plague. It was all in Western and Northern India. And the officials thought they had done a great job. And this is about, you know, pandemic management, saying that they had kept away the plague. It turned out later, it was about the nature of the rats and rat fleas. And they were just not, you know, there. They didn't have a plague ecology in Eastern India and Southern India. So there are reasons which we, so we are in that, you know, period between 1898 and 1905 during plague, where people were just conjecturing. And only when the transmission of plague was laid bare, that people started understanding regional variations. I think it's just very early to speculate.
I agree. And I think this is going to be a journalistic enterprise. I don't think this is a question to be answered by scientists or virologists. I think this will require a deep dive by someone like, you know, you, Laura, or Chinmay, perhaps a Pulitzer Prize winning book on why there's been such variability in mortality statistics. The audience questions are coming in, and I'm just going through some of them. Uma Gupta asks, Camus' novel, The Plague, had profound impact in terms of issues it raised in terms of the human condition. What do you believe would be the takeaway from the current pandemic, philosophically speaking? Which one of you would
want to ask? We're not immortal. We think we've conquered infectious diseases, and we have not. I don't know about philosophy, but I'll seize on the opportunity to make a point which I didn't make earlier, which is that there's a fascinating conversation at the moment going on in amongst people who work in memory studies about whether this pandemic might buck the trend of forgettability of pandemics, in the sense that, as Chinmay was saying, this is really the first major digitally witnessed pandemic. If you wanted to, over the last year, you could watch infection rates and mortality rates practically in real time. So we've all had access to all the available data practically since the beginning. And will the fact that that information has been there, we've all had it at our fingertips, change the formation of our memories about it? So, well, I think you could think about it as a natural experiment in pandemic memory. I'm not sure if that's a philosophical takeaway, but that's my offer.
Yeah, you know, I just point out a very India-specific change in the, I think, general perception is that last year we had two crises. We had a pandemic crisis, and then we had a migration crisis. And just a coincidence that I've written a book on migration and pandemics. But I think what 2020 would have changed is that I think a class of workers in India who were invisibilized for far too long were literally thrown out on streets, and you know they had to walk back home. And I think you can see there's a whole new approach towards understanding that, you know, India has more than 100 million migrant workers. And I think that's one thing that's changed in India. So when you talk about Camus and the condition of people, I think this particular pandemic in India has shown the condition, the plight of migrant workers. And so I think hopefully that will change. People have suddenly realized that these guys exist, you know, in our cities, and we need better, you know, up our game into providing welfare services for this important class. So I think that's a huge shift in the mindset. People simply had no clue that there were so many people and the precarious lives that they were living. And I think that's an important kind of change that the pandemic is definitely.
That will change things. I mean, is it already changing things?
Because I've been working on migration for 10 years. I've been part of policymaking groups. Wherever I go, people are keen. They're keen to understand how do we help migrant workers. You know, that was never there before the pandemic. So there's clearly a shift. It was unfortunate that we required a migration crisis to start talking about this. But I think that's something which has happened.
Right. Would you like to riff on the hereafter? How is it going to change the world? As someone said, never make the mistake of saying that, you know, the world would never be the same again.
Let me say that I think that often when people are inside a pandemic, as we are now, they talk about how the world will never be the same again. And then they immediately forget the pandemic as soon as they're out of it. That's been the track record up till now. Although, as I just said, this could break the trend. This could be different. The other thing I think that happens is that people make predictions in the pandemic of how the world will change, and those things aren't necessarily borne out, but other things change. So, I think pandemics have a habit of accelerating trends that were already in place, already underway. So you could see 1918 as having accelerated the move to socialized medicine in many countries, I think. And to the need for some kind of global public health organization that would coordinate responses to such crises in future. Then you see the forerunners of the WHO being born. This time, what will we see? So having just said it's very dangerous to make predictions, people say we'll be traveling less, we'll think about the climate more. I doubt somehow, maybe in some ways, but you know, we were all very excited about Zoom and then we all got started talking about Zoom fatigue. So, I think we've realized that Zoom is wonderful for many things, but in-person meetings are also quite good. So maybe we'll find some kind of middle ground there. I'm quite interested in what's been happening in medicine. I think there has been probably, and here I'll stick my neck out, an important shift towards telemedicine. That will probably stay around. It's difficult to predict because there is a danger with it of reinforcing inequalities that already existed in access to healthcare, because now you have to have access to IT as well. But I think it also has the potential to democratize medicine, to increase access if we handle it properly. And I think one other thing we've learned this year is that hospitals in the sense that we understand them today in the modern world are eminently unsuited to pandemics, because you bring everybody together from all specialties in one place and present them with a contagious bug. So I think the way that we understand the concept of a hospital might change, and the way that that medicine is delivered might well change. Those are my two suggestions for today.
Yeah, I talk about climate change. One of the things the lockdown kind of, really showed us is that if you have no activity, suddenly the air can get cleaner. In Delhi, I believe, suddenly in northern India, we had these social media memes that you can see the Himalayas. And there's this whole narrative that actually it's such a cleaner world. It is possible, though obviously not practical. And so it might, I think, prompt, people who have seen this possibility, that is, if you actually have no economic activity, things can change overnight. The quality of air can improve overnight. I think that might prompt some very smart kind of solutions, hopefully, in the future. Maybe, no cars allowed on Sunday in Delhi. I don't know, Ambrish, might have a better view on that.
And you think the economy is going to bounce back? We'll see the roaring 20s again?
Well, that's pretty. We know it's a roaring 2021 because of what we call as a base effect. If you fall by 10%, you have to come back, by 15%. So we know if 2021 is a roaring year, that's just mathematically so. But economists are just about as bad as astrologers in predicting the global economy. The IMF forecast for the global I'm saying this, because they study, economists can predict just about 3 or 4 months down the line. Beyond 2 years or 3 years forecasts, they are as bad, and a five-year forecast is as bad as a coin flip. So this is how, if you look at the IMF forecast of the last 25 years, that's how it is. So it's very tough, to make these predictions. But I think this move to a cleaner kind of, less carbon-intensive life, I'll take a shot and say maybe the pandemic will accelerate, that shift. Let's see.
I just hope people,
Sorry, just going to finish the thought about the rebound, which is that I think we will see a rebound, but if the rebound is proportional to the size of the loss of the extent of the disaster, then we won't see. Then the Roaring Twenties was a response to 50 to 100 million people dead out of a global population that was a quarter the size of today. So this is a blip on the screen compared to that, and proportionally, I don't know what Chinmay would think. The rebound won't be so marked either.
Yeah, completely. In relative terms, from the pandemics we have studied, this is a pandemic with very little mortality as a proportion to the global population as of now, and hopefully it stays that way in terms of relative comparisons. And so all the classic big changes, Black Death, 1/3 of Europe perished, 6% of India's population, influenza. The labor movement in India really picks up in the 1920s. thanks to this massive mortality that happened in 1918 in India. And so, you're not going to see those demographic shocks, because I don't think they are substantial enough to make a complete alteration like the 14th century Black Death or like the Age of Pandemics. But I think the fact that everyone has got this one shock of alternate possibilities that you can have education online, that you can have you can have clean air. I think that when people have seen it, that these are things are possible, I think it can activate more energy in those lines.
Right. So when you get into IIM, you just don't get into haloed real estate and buy into a certain kind of peer group. I think it makes more sense to show up. But thank you. This has been most enlightening. And I'll recommend that all of you should go and buy these two books. They're absolutely compelling. And perhaps the sweet meeting point between great narrative and historical scholarship. That's all we have time for. Thank you all for joining us. Thank you, Laura and Chinmay.
Thanks, Ambrish. And I should just point out that Ambrish himself has a book called Perineum, which is on epidemics and history, which is also worth reading.
Thank you for listening to Jaipur Bites, the JLF podcast. I'm your host, Laksh Datta. This podcast is produced by Launchora in association with Teamwork Arts. Please subscribe or follow to this show wherever you're listening to this.